So I was asked to talk about how women have become maybe the pivotal focus of this presidential campaign and how it might be translated into power as opposed to lip service. And it's true that we have the biggest gender gap in history, embodied by especially single women and women of color. It is only white married women who remain evenly split between the presidential candidates. That says something about being born Republican and about being married. Situations you see. One, there is a belief that the Republican Party is still Republican, when in fact it began to be taken over by former racist Democrats, with Jesse Helms. Remember, some of us here are old enough to remember Jesse Helms, right? after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, when the Democratic Party became too inclusive for the old Dixiecrats, and they began to move over and take over the Republican Party. In fact, Goldwater was pro-choice. Nixon supported the Equal Rights Amendment. The first President Bush supported Planned Parenthood. And even Reagan supported immigration. None of the past Republican leaders could get nominated by this nomination process that has been taken over by, of course, anti-choice, by a combination, I would say, of economic and religious, very profoundly conservative, not to say authoritarian, forces. There are 8,000 fundamentalist Baptist churches, they tell us, and they used to be either apolitical or democratic, but now they are vote delivery systems for the Republican Party, especially since the second President Bush gave so much money to faith-based organizations that even the New York Times can't figure out how many billions there were given on executive order alone, never went through Congress. We have now a centrist party and an extremist party, and yet the news coverage behaves as if we have two parties. It is so dangerous for one of our two great parties to begin to be controlled by extremists, because it causes many people, perhaps most people, to believe that issues, if you look at the public opinion polls, these issues are 60-40 or 70-30. They are not 50-50. They are not. There's virtually nothing in the Republican Party platform except perhaps capital punishment, which still has the majority support even from Republicans. And yet the coverage and the impression and the historical impression that we have two equally divided parties leads people to believe that and leads our media to cover even-handedly. It's not even-handedly. Personally, I think we will one day get to the place where we no longer say, in any case, even not just in this one, but in any case, that there are two sides to every issue. That is historically rooted in the idea of masculine and feminine. Other cultures that don't have that kind of bipartite division don't say there are two, because there may be three, there may be 10, there may be 12. It is outrageous that our highest standard of fairness is to say there are two sides to every issue, a longer question that we have to debate. Second, we have allowed the welfare of the female half of the country to be called a social issue, not an economic issue and an every other kind of issue. And we have to think about our own acceptance of this that's out there in the air as reporters. In actual fact, a single issue, the one with which most Americans agree, which is equal pay, or with which Americans agree the most, I should say, since many are majority issues, equal pay for females alone and for comparable work alone would be the greatest economic stimulus this country could ever have. As the Institute for Women's Policy Research has carefully researched, white women would receive $148 more a week on the average. Women of color, doubly discriminated against because they're comparing to white guys with a comparable job, right, would receive $262 more a week. We would have a total of $200 billion more circulating in the economy every year. And that money would be spent. It would be inserted in the economy exactly where it's most likely to be spent. Those women are not going to invest in China. They are not going to send their money to a bank account in the island someplace. No, they are going to spend it and they are going to create jobs. How can we allow equal pay and anything affecting the female half of the country to be called a social issue? It is the single biggest economic issue in this country. So is reproduction. Because whether or not a woman can decide when and whether to have children is the single biggest determinant of how much she earns, is she educated, what her health is, whether she works outside the home or not at all, and how long she lives. Reproductive freedom determines everything else for women, and it determines the fate of nation states altogether. Reproduction is even more fundamental than production. Yet we understand that production is a serious issue, and we have allowed reproduction to be diminished into a social issue. The surest way to be poor in this country is to ever have born one child and be over 65. Those two things, regardless of what group we come from, are most likely to make us poor. The social issue of women's equality happens to be also the determinant of violence in society and the biggest predictor of war and peace. We have a high rate of family violence and femicide, that is, murdering people simply because they are female in this country. Not the highest in the world by any means, but a much higher than other European countries, than Canada, than Australia, than New Zealand. We have a very high rate. For instance, since 9/11, more women have been murdered by their husbands or boyfriends than all the people killed in 9/11, all the Americans killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, combined. And yet Romney is against, or to be accurate, refuses to support the Violence Against Women Act. He dares to refuse to support the Violence Against Women Act, and so do almost every Republican in Congress. And that figure of femicide is not counting the murders people in this part of the country know so well on the border, the murders of women. I mean, this is only counting convictions of husbands or boyfriends who have murdered the women in their lives. This has such far-reaching impact, not only in our country, but in every country. And for your reporting, I really want to commend to you a book which I brought for show and tell here, Sex and World Peace by Valerie Hudson and four other scholars, which proves in infinite detail of more than 100 countries in this world that the single greatest determinant of whether a country is violent internally or is violent toward its neighbors, whether informally or through the military, the single greatest determinant is not whether that country is poor or not, not whether they suffer from lack of natural resources or not, not religion, not even degree of democracy. It is violence against females. That is the greatest predictor of whether or not a country will, for instance, be violent towards its neighbors because it doesn't have enough natural resources. Whatever the situation is, it is more likely to be solved by negotiation and without violence if the country does not have a profound tradition of violence against females, and that includes everything from female infanticide through neglect or through the ever-mounting use of technology to reinforce prejudice, which now means that women are no longer the majority of the world. There are millions of missing women every year. It includes child marriage. It includes female genital mutilation. It includes honor killings. It includes all the forms, and our own femicide and domestic violence. It includes all the forms of violence against females as the greatest indicator. Why? Not because of any saying for a moment that a crime against a female is greater than a crime against a male. It's not. All crimes are crimes against a human being. But because this is the first form of violence, domination, power we see as children, it normalizes every other form and offers the pattern for every other form. And we dare to call it a social issue. The relations between half the human race and the other half are the most fundamental economic, political, military, every other foreign policy, every other kind of issue we could imagine. But where is this knowledge in our foreign policy? We seem to be readying to leave Afghanistan, for instance, without a major emphasis, hard to tell from the coverage, probably none of us are sure about this in this room, but without a major emphasis on whether or not we leave the root of violence in that country, which is the domination and violence toward and murder of females. So, you know, I think that we understand, we're beginning to understand the linkage, but the linkage isn't out there. And so women read every day of the diminishing of our issues as if they were minor. They feel almost guilty. Really, I mean, talking to women campaigning, they feel guilty if they dare to think that reproductive freedom is as important as Detroit. You know, it is not yet in our consciousness how fundamental this caste system of polarized gender roles, masculine and feminine, which has always been the greatest mark of whether or not small societies, we've always known it was the greatest indicator of violence in small societies, and now we have proven that it is in modern states, in more than 100 modern states, it is also the greatest indicator. We also don't quite understand, perhaps, our adversaries may understand this better than we do, that all the movements are connected. All our social justice movements are interconnected. On campus, sometimes people say to me, why is it that the same groups are against lesbians and birth control? Well, it's obvious that they are trying to tell us the lie about human sexuality, which is that it's only moral and okay if it's directed towards having children, and in their view, inside patriarchal marriage, so they're properly owned. So of course, women who for our survival have to separate sexuality and reproduction, and two men or two women who love each other, are symbolic of the separation of sexuality and reproduction, which incidentally is a mark of our humanity, like our ability to reason or remember. I mean, animals think and feel, but only humans seem to think about thinking and about feeling. It's our cerebral cortex. So for us, I mean, I always feel that, I fear that I'm maligning animals when I say this, but I, that it seems that other animals have periods of heat or estrus in which sexual desire is focused. Human beings uniquely never have. Sexuality for us has always been not only a way we procreate if we choose to, and we have always been able to separate sexuality and reproduction. All the native nations on this continent totally understood that until the Europeans arrived and suppressed it and punished it and so on with religion and patriarchal hierarchy and so on. We have always had as a mark of our humanity, like reasoning and remembering, that sexuality is a way we bond and we express closeness and caring. Yet we are still being lied to about sexuality. Well, that makes clear why the women's movement and the gay and lesbian movements have always come together. Whether it was in Europe or here or in any other country, they have always come together because we share the need to liberate sexual expression from being solely directed towards reproduction. And it is 100% clear that sex and race are inextricably intertwined. We should know that in this country, of all places, where they were so obviously deeply intertwined in the South. You have, if you're going to maintain race or a visible difference, you have to control reproduction. So you have to take the wrongly called superior women and isolate them so the race remains pure, quote unquote, and the so-called inferior women and exploit them sexually so you have cheap labor. There is no such thing as being a feminist and not being anti-racist. It just doesn't work. And there's no such thing as being an anti-racist, not also being a feminist. And yet we were subjected in 2008 to a long campaign that asked us nothing but which is more important, sex or race. It was outrageous, truly, truly outrageous. And especially outrageous that I or Oprah or somebody, regardless of who we supported, I mean, they were so close on the issues, you had to be on LSD to know they were different, right? But we were suddenly told that we were valuing one over the other based on who we supported. It was outrageous. So, you know, I wonder whether we truly understand the connections and the fact that our movements are all linked. We are all after a society in which we are linked, not ranked. It's very simple. Now, I don't know what's going to happen, but I just want to remind us here how important are the women who vote are, all right? So I've prepared a little litany here, so brace yourself, okay. Those of us who remember the race in the 1980s in Missouri of Harriet Woods against John Danforth for the U.S. Senate, I know there's golden oldies here who remember this, okay. All right, I always loved Harriet Woods' race because she was such a classic entrant. She became a political candidate for a county committee, I think, because she had little children. There was a manhole cover outside her house that when the cars went over, it made a tremendous racket. It woke up her children. All right, it was a classic entrance into political life, and she turned out to be a great candidate. She was on the county committee, she was in the state legislature, she had a television show, she was enormously popular, and ultimately she ran for U.S. Senate against John Danforth, who had been an Episcopalian priest, the Attorney General of Missouri, and was the heir to the Ralston Purina fortune. But she was like running against the whole patriarchy combined. She did great. She was defeating him. Even though she was pro-choice in Missouri, which is supposed to be a anti-choice state, which it isn't, but that's the mythology, she was winning even in Little Dixie, which is the most conservative part of the state. In the last week, predictable huge amounts of money arrived and distorted her positions in television commercials, and she didn't have the money to meet it. And it was so clearly the problem of that last minute money that it was the reason why Emily's List was formed, if you'll remember. Okay. She lost by less than 1%. I think it was just a couple thousand votes. It was definitely much less than 1% of the vote. That meant that John Danforth went to Washington and took with him on his staff his dear friend, who had been on his staff previously, and also a lawyer at Monsanto, you know, doing genetically modified seeds and so on, Clarence Thomas. Danforth took Clarence Thomas with him on his staff. So he was there in Washington visibly as that most valuable thing, somebody who comes from a group and is willing to go against its majority opinion. So he was made head of the EEOC, where he proceeded to dismantle the class action possibilities and so on, and incidentally made all of the staff read The Fountainhead. You can't make this stuff up. Okay. Then he was momentarily on the Court of Appeals, if you'll remember, and then he was present to replace the great civil rights advocate Thurgood Marshall. And we all remember what happened after that with the hearings. Okay, so that because of that Missouri race, Clarence Thomas is on the Supreme Court. He was arguably the deciding vote in refusing to recount the Florida ballots, which by any measure were won by Gore. Later on, they were surveyed. By any uniform standard, they were won by Gore. Right. So if we had had a couple of thousand more votes for a good woman in Missouri, which includes men's votes too, but she was a beneficiary of the gender gap, then the second Bush couldn't have caused the biggest transfer of wealth from public to private hands in the history of the nation, or yet another optional war in Iraq, or high-level disbelief in global warming, or public schools with abstinence-only sex education enforced by federal funding, which have given us now the highest rate of unwanted pregnancies in the developed world, or an executive order giving billions of our tax dollars to faith-based centers of right-wing political power, or the global gag rule that deprived poor countries of U.S. foreign aid if they offered information on abortion even with their own money, which has killed millions, literally millions of women in the world since then, or corporate profiteering or privatized prisons at home. I mean, that in itself is huge. The persuasion with the leadership of Texas that you need to build more prisons and therefore you need to fill them. You know, South Africa used to have the record, but now that they are independent, we have the record, and profoundly racist in its effect. Or corporate CEOs whose salaries rose from 30 times that of the average worker before the right-wing backlash took over Washington, to now an average of 1,000 times the average worker, or an unregulated financial industry that led to a worldwide economic meltdown that increased divisions between rich and poor, and much more. So the voting booth is the only place on earth in which the least powerful equal the most powerful. And frankly, I fear, in answer to the initial question that was asked me, which is how women have become and maybe the pivotal focus of this campaign and how it might be translated into power as opposed as opposed to just lip service. If, with the biggest gender gap in history, the most anti-equality presidential candidate in history, we do not re-elect Obama, I fear we'll never be taken seriously again, or for a very long time. I mean, I'm a hopeaholic, so I would always start over. but for a very, very long time. So I hope that we can just get the facts out there and make clear that these issues are not social issues to be dispensed with. These are economic issues, they are national issues, and they are global issues on this spaceship Earth that we love so much.